The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
More than a million people have been caught up in violent protests in France over the government's decision to raise the pension age to 64.
Protesters launched an all-out assault in Paris, looting stores, lighting fires, and charging at police.
The violence swept the streets of Paris like a tidal wave. Shrouded in a smokescreen of chaos, hundreds of thousands clashed with police, their throats filled with tear gas as they fought to have their voices heard. Their fight is with President Emmanuel Macron, but on the streets it is those in riot gear and those without who are at war.
It's really frightening. This has clearly become about something so much greater than pension reform. This is now a fight to topple the president.
It does look like bank jitters are here to stay. The latest victim is German lender Deutsche Bank, seeing its stock take a big hit this morning after fresh worries about the health and safety of its business. We saw a spike in credit default swaps. Germany's chancellor has weighed in on the matter, saying that Deutsche Bank is very profitable and there's no need for concern.
Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell said at the central bank's March meeting that recent banking sector turmoil could result in banks becoming more strict in extending credit.
Events in the banking system over the past 2 weeks are likely to result in tighter credit conditions for households and businesses, which would in turn affect economic outcomes.
In other words, a credit crunch is coming.
A credit crunch is the inability of households and businesses to get the credit that they need.
Zandi says the concern stems from the recent collapse of Silicon Valley Bank in California and Signature Bank in New York, both of which failed when a flood of customers rushed to get their money out.
Of course, those deposits are critical to the ability of those banks to make loans. You know, they take the deposits, the banks, they turn around and they lend out those deposits to households and businesses. If there's no deposits, if the deposits are leaving, then they can't make loans. If they can't make loans, that's a credit crunch.
As access to credit shrinks, businesses can get squeezed, and that can have a domino effect.
Now actual banks are changing their credit standards. And like in the state of California, where First Republic Bank and Silicon Valley Bank were huge, you know, players in many specialty markets, not having them actively lending will definitely affect the economy here in California, which is one of the biggest economies in the world. And so now we're going to see some real pain coming to small business owners and innovation companies and lost jobs because of the lack of lending that will go into these areas that were traditionally serviced by these banks.
Zandi agrees, as tighter credit could put the overall economy at risk.
If businesses can't get a loan, they can't pay their employees, they can't pay their bills, they can't go out and expand, they can't invest. If households can't get a loan, they can't get a car, they can't get a mortgage, they can't buy an appliance, they can't do a home improvement. And, you know, of course, that means the economy is going to be struggling because of all that.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
Well, it was another rough week for the stock market as jitters over bank failures permeated the minds of investors, Deutsche Bank being the latest mega bank under siege. Fears mount that there could be more takeovers over the weekend, and the flip-flopping by Treasury Secretary Yellen hasn't helped calm investor fears. Jitters in the banking sector may begin to impact companies big and small, which may lose access to credit, impacting the economy. There could be more trouble ahead for the markets as earnings estimates for companies are coming down ahead of Q1 earnings. There are also signs that inflation could tick up in the second quarter, putting the Fed in a bind. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplavin. Welcome to the Financial Sense News Hour. Up on deck, John Kozar from Asbury Research joins me. John's major indicators are still in the risk-off mode. He also sees a breakout in gold as gold crosses 2,000 for the first time since last year. And next up is Sarah Lindsay from Synergy One Lending. Despite falling real estate prices, Sarah sees demand remaining strong due to a lack of supply. Sarah sees mortgage rates falling and home builders are offering discounts to buy down those mortgage rates. Finally, Chris Poplava and Chris Sheridan will be here with another edition of Smart Macro. But first, let's find out the events moving the markets this week with Ryan Poplava.
The main drivers this week moving stocks, bonds, and commodities were the ongoing banking concerns and a policy decision by the Federal Open Market Committee this week. Starting off with the banking issues, confidence was building in the banks with the Swiss National Bank brokered acquisition of Credit Suisse by UBS for a price of $3.2 billion. At the same time, there was a coordinated central bank action with the Fed, Bank of Canada, Bank of England, Bank of Japan, and the European Central Bank and Swiss Bank to increase U.S. dollar liquidity while also making statements to try and reassure investors that the U.S. banking system is strong and resilient. Confidence continued in the financial sector Tuesday as financials led a rally in stocks with the S&P 500 reaching levels it saw previous to the Silicon Valley Bank financial situation just a couple of weeks ago. Yields were also on the rise ahead of the FOMC meeting with the two-year note yield up 24 basis points to 4.16% and the 10-year yield up 9 basis points to 3.57%. Later in the week, two situations hurt banking confidence with comments from Treasury Secretary Yellen stating the administration was not considering expanding bank deposit guarantees beyond the current limit of $250,000, which caused the stock market to fall Wednesday afternoon. Thursday and Friday, concerns began to rise over Deutsche Bank as the stock fell and credit default swaps were on the rise. German Chancellor Scholz and ECB President Lagarde tried to reassure investors, but confidence continues to be one of the things investors lack. It's so bad that a recent Bank of America Global Fund Manager survey showed that investor sentiment is as close to the lowest levels it has been in 20 years. The two-year Treasury yield finished the week at 3.77%, down 5 basis points, and the 10-year Treasury yield finished at 3.38%, down 15 basis points. Mind you, on March 8th, the two-year was near 5% and is now just 3.77%, as investors have flocked to safety. Gold finished the week at $1,983, up $10, not far from its all-time high in the low 2000s. Moving on to our next news item this week, the Federal Reserve meeting on Wednesday. The Federal Open Market Committee was unanimous in its decision to raise rates a quarter point to a target rate between 4.75% and 5%. The summary of economic projections showed the Fed's median terminal rate was at 5.1%, unchanged from December. The language in the statement changed to some additional policy firming instead of ongoing, which caused many to believe the Fed may raise rates one more meeting and then pause. But if you look at the CME FedWatch tool, as of Friday, it's predicting an 80% chance of a pause at the next meeting the first week of May. Powell's commentary during the press conference showed the Fed is still highly attentive to inflation risk, but his comments did little to reassure the public about the recent banking issues. He suggested that instead of pausing, the bank's financial stability tools are its lending facilities, the discount window, and the recent bank term funding program. He also admitted that the recent banking events are likely to result in some tightening of credit conditions for households and businesses and could act as equivalent rate hikes or more, but that it's too soon to tell what the outcome may be with any certainty. When asked if banking issues with Silicon Valley Bank could translate into other areas, especially commercial real estate, he said the banking system is strong and well-capitalized, and he didn't see that the over-concentration people have in commercial real estate would succumb to recent banking weakness. On the economic front this week, housing data was seeing a pickup in activity as a result of the drop in rates. Existing home sales surged 14.5% in February, the first rise in 13 months. Mortgage applications rose 3% and refinancing apps were up 5%. New home sales rose 1.1% over the previous month, but are still down about 19% from a year ago. Unemployment claims still remain low, below 200,000, and durable goods orders fell 1% for the month. So there you have it, ongoing banking issues and how those issues are spilling into Fed policy with a change to some additional firming may be necessary. While the Fed funds futures are predicting this was the last rate for now. Up next, this week's guest technician, John Kosar.
As of the end of January, you looked at lending standards in the Fed Senior Loan Officer Survey that had already begun to tighten up. In fact, with respect specifically to commercial industrial loans, not including COVID, you had the tightest standards since 2009. So things were slowing even before this. and it's only going to get exaggerated. I mean, if you're a loan officer at a bank, you're now focused on not making mistakes rather than aggressively searching out for new business. If you are a commercial real estate lender and a borrower that owns an office building wants to hand you back the keys, well, you don't even want the keys back. So this is going to lead to less loans for small and medium-sized businesses. And again, in the context of an economy that was fragile to begin with.
To listen to this full interview, in addition to gaining access to all of our premium content airing during the week, go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button.
At a time, bank deposits offer very low interest and could be at risk. Corporate cash accounts are also progressively losing ground to inflation. At Financial Sense Wealth Management, we offer a solution to this problem. Our firm specializes in assisting companies by managing cash balances with short-term treasuries and high-quality corporate bonds that may provide higher interest rates. This approach not only helps to manage your corporate cash balances with competitive yields, but also to help reduce taxes through the use of treasury securities, which are exempt from state and local income taxes. Give us a call today at 888-486-3939 to find out how we can assist you to earn higher interest rates with no bank risk and no state and local income taxes. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
It looks like stocks are trying to make a comeback after the Fed hiked interest rates a quarter of a point. What does this all mean for the stock market? Joining us on the program is John Kosar from Asbury Research. John, you have two indicators, but I want to begin with one that you have. It's called your correction protection. What is that telling you right now, given the state of the market?
The correction protection model, we call it CPM, that has been risk off since February the 21st. And prior to that, it was risk on since right around the beginning of the year. So we're currently in risk off mode right now, according to CPM.
Okay. And then you also have something you call it your Asbury 6. Explain what that indicator does and what does it tell you?
Yeah, the Asbury 6, I actually built the Asbury 6 probably 5-6 years ago when the algorithmic trading, the intraday trading really became kind of a hindrance. I'm talking about, well, yesterday and today. You know, yesterday or the day before yesterday, the market was up whatever, 40 or 50. It got slammed yesterday on the close on Fed Day. And now today it's up how much it was out last, you know, yesterday. And even more. So rather than try to watch the S&P 500 and maybe volume, which you used to be able to do in the quote unquote old days, I backtested my favorite tactical indicators throughout my career and in sets of three, sets of four, sets of five. And I tried to find a group of them that would give me a better day-to-day indication of what the health of the market is. So I came up with six indicators, only one of which has to do directly with the S&P 500. It actually measures the rate of change in the S&P 500. The other ones are things like corporate bond spreads, trading volume, asset flows that can't be affected by the day-to-day volatility that you see in the markets. And that particular indicator, that has been negative since the same day, since February the 21st. So since Feb 21, we have been kind of watching and waiting. There have been some places to invest, but generally speaking, we've been kind of on the sidelines here and waiting for direction since February 21.
I want to talk about something we're seeing. Last year, the FANG stocks got hit pretty hard. But if you look at some of the charts of some of these stocks, you can look at Apple, Meta, even Alphabet. These stocks have been making a comeback. What's your take there?
That's a good question. I mean, I've seen it developing. We have a few ETF ideas out there now, even though we're in a risk-off environment, according to our models. And it's XLK, XNTK, semiconductors. And I'm not sure. I mean, I'm looking at a chart of the NDX here, and we had that nice breakout that we had at the end of January through the 200-day moving average. We came back and retested the 200-day moving average on March, let's call it March 13th, and now we're bumping up against fresh highs. I don't know how to quantify that. It might be in this environment where it's been so choppy. The money seems to be going defensive one week and offensive the next. It may, in a sense, be kind of a flight to bigger, stronger companies that may be able to handle whatever's going on a little bit better.
I want to go to another asset class that it looks like it's wanting to break out, and that is gold. We saw it touch briefly over 2000. It's pulled back a little bit, but it's very close. So what's your take on gold here?
I think gold has broken out. We actually started to buy gold back in beginning of December. We bought gold. It was coming off of some pretty important lows, we thought. And we saw asset flows starting to expand in GLD. That's a big deal for us. We need to see three things. Generally speaking, we need to see a positive trend. We need to see relative outperformance versus the S&P. And we need to see asset flows coming in, which is trend fuel, basically. It sustains the trend. So we actually got in beginning of December. We got out of that trade on February the 9th, I'm sorry to say, because we saw the assets starting to leave. We had a pretty good pullback off of the highs that we made right at the beginning of February. We have not engaged this move back up. And the reason for that is because it happened so fast. We had the banking crisis come up right around, well, it was March 8, March 9 is when it first started to get in the news. And obviously, our stock market got slammed, and that money went back into GLD so quickly. I'm looking at GLD, which is a Spider Gold Trust. It went back into there so fast as a flight to safety that we never got those asset flows that we needed to put the trade on. Right now, we're running up against a resistance level in GLD, about 185. We're trading at 184 right now, but I'm also looking at silver miners. I'm looking at gold miners. I'm seeing those asset flows starting to catch up, telling me that this move may be more than just a 1 or 2 week flight to safety reaction to what happened in the banking situation here, and it might be something more sustainable. So yes, I do think it's a good idea, and we're looking for a good entry point.
Let's talk about its sister metal, silver. That looks like that's breaking out too.
It does. The one we're looking at, actually, because it just has a little bit better asset flows, is the silver miners, and that is SLVP. I'm actually, you can probably hear my keyboard. I'm actually pulling that up now. Asset flows have been particularly strong there, and that's another one that we are looking at. And for me, with our tactical models risk off since Feb 21, I'm much more inclined to try to put some money to work in a non-equities part of the market. So we look at 40, 50 different commodity markets via ETFs, and we're looking for opportunities there. But that would be, of those two, silver miners seems to have just a little bit more conviction in terms of the flows that we've seen in there.
And I want to talk about Dr. Copper. Copper at $4 now, that's come off its lows from, let's say, last fall. They always say you want to know where the economy's going, look at copper. What's your take there?
Copper has been a tough one to trade. There hasn't been a lot of, as soon as it starts meeting the criteria that I need to see, it seems to lose it. We've been looking at XME for a while, too. We actually were long XME, which is the metals and mining ETF, obviously a little more broader than just copper. And looking at copper now as we speak, I'd like to see a little bit more strength here. It's kind of pulled back into what I would call a support area. I would not buy it yet. I'm testing the 200-day moving average there. That's a good sign. But what we do not have yet is relative outperformance versus the S&P 500. Started underperforming in the beginning of March, still underperforming on a quarterly basis. So that's another criteria for me. If I see an opportunity anywhere that looks like it has some whatever good asset flows, good structure to a chart, but it's not outperforming the S&P 500, it comes off my list. In my view, if you're not outperforming the S&P 500, why go elsewhere?
Let's go to a sector within the S&P, and that's the banking system, the financials. And I'm looking at XLF, and it looks terrible. And I'm not sure we're through this banking crisis yet. It was interesting in the press conference accompanying the Fed hike. Powell did not look that confident up there on the stage.
No, I wouldn't want his job.
Me either.
He's the target of every Monday morning quarterback on the planet, and I don't want his job. Here's what I'm seeing. Obviously, XLF was interesting because of how this hits so hard. I've got another model. It's called SEAF is the acronym. It's Sector ETF Asset Flows. And we had been seeing a significant percentage of assets flowing into XLF at various times since the beginning of the year. But that banking, you know, the issue hit, I think it was the 8th is when it first showed up in the news. And that move down that XLF has made is interesting to me, because if you look at a longer term chart of XLF, you've got a really important high in XLF that was made about $31. And then there are other kind of secondary old highs right around the $31 level. And we're right on top of it. So we're basically sitting on the old support level. What does that tell me? It tells me that if all I'm interested in is risk reward here, the risk reward here is great, because either it holds 31 bucks or it's going to potentially go a lot lower than this, quite a bit lower. This could really turn out to be something that could take XLF quite a bit lower. And of course, that fits in with the whole question. Is this banking issue, is this a one-off? Is this isolated? Or is this the tip of the iceberg? And there's something else, you know, there's a lot more ice underneath the water that we don't see yet. And that's the beauty, I think, sometimes of looking at charts, is if you can integrate what's happening in the economy, what's happening in the news, and then you look at the chart, and the chart tells you, yes, this is a point of inflection. I don't think I would touch this here. I want to see some asset flows coming back. And obviously it's been a fire sale there. Everyone's been coming out of there and going into technology, you know, is really what it's been, you know, a little bit semis. But should this hold, because we're at this long-term support level that goes, again, all the way back to 07. I mean, this 31 support level goes back to June of 07. If this can hold down here and just on a daily basis, right, start getting some moving averages turning, start seeing some asset flow, start seeing some relative outperformance versus the S&P, this could turn out to be a tremendous buying opportunity in the months to come.
You know, one thing I learned early on in my career, now it came from Marty Zweig, never fight the Fed. So the Fed yesterday indicated that, yeah, they raised only a quarter of a point, and they sort of hinted we may be coming to the end of that, but they also hinted another rate hike is coming. And you just wonder, John, at what point, you know, I guess the question is they keep raising until something breaks. Well, was Silicon Valley Bank, was that the break? I guess we don't know yet, especially if they keep raising interest rates.
I don't think the Fed does either. I mean, you know, there's no, I suppose, you know, there are people on the inside that have obviously a much better view of the situation than we do. But tough situation to be in. You know, you've got inflationary pressures on one side, and you have a potential emerging banking crisis on the other. So, I mean, you know, they really can't do anything but talk out of both sides of their mouth and make sure they're covered on both sides and be very careful not to spook the market, I think is all they can do. So, yeah, that's a tough call. Interestingly, if you look at the Russell 2000, and the Russell is generally seen as kind of the tip of the spear, it's generally where investors go if they want to take on more risk than just buying like a plain vanilla S&P 500. The Russell is sitting, I'm actually pulling up the chart now so I can speak to it. And what reminded me of this was because we're talking about this long-term support level in XLF. Well, the Russell has been testing this 1750 to 1700 level for a while. It is the August 2018 and January 2020 peaks. previous peaks. I wish I had a chart here because it'll just jump out at you and bite you. It's just so compelling. We were down there four times last year and held it all four times in the middle of May, middle of June, middle of October, and the end of December. And now we're down there now. If the Russell starts trading underneath 1700 steadily, I'm not talking about 2 days, going down 20 index points. I'm talking where it's obvious that it has broken this level. This would open the door for a much larger move down in the Russell. And obviously, if the Russell is part of the broad market, I think it would be a bad omen, kind of a leading indication that we're going to have a tough second quarter and going into the summer. The flip side of that is if we can hold in here and turn higher, if this dragging the market higher by big cap tech can get something started on the upside here and then get more participation from other parts of the market. Again, this could be a really tremendous opportunity to buy. So I think that's the message here, is because our tactical metrics are weak right now, I think it's too soon to go great guns back into the market. But there are selected areas that are doing well. And again, if we can hold in here, I think we can have a very nice move higher that can take us out 1 to 3 quarters.
So in summing up right now, your correction protection model, you've been in risk off since February, and you're still right now risk off. So the takeaway here, if you were an investor, John, would you wait on the sidelines and just to see how this plays out? What would you be doing?
What we're doing is we're selectively in parts of the market that are doing well, actually pulling some of those up, like some of what we're interested in right now. It's a short list. We've got semiconductors. We've got a couple of different ETFs that have to do with technology. And just recently, we put on communication services. That looks like that can have some legs. So it's kind of all in that higher beta stuff, more places where investors usually go if they want more risk, if they have larger risk appetite. But in terms of putting more money to work, this is bottom fishing for me, actually. This is how I look at this. We're sitting on these support levels. We're sitting on this giant support level in the S&P 500. We broke out on January the 23rd. We came back and we retested this. The support's at about 3850. And we tested it from March 10 to March 14 or 15. Now we're starting to move higher. If the market's good, it's good from here. But until our internal metrics, again, CPM did really well last year. CPM outperformed the S&P by 13.5% last year. I'm not fading that. Until that gives me the green light, then I'll be more comfortable putting larger positions, more broad-based positions on there, rather than just, it'll be more of a shotgun approach at that point, as opposed to the rifle approach, what we're doing now, trying to pick the places that are outperforming, showing me some asset flows, which is basically technology and semis. So not yet, but this could turn rather quickly.
All right. Well, listen, John, as we close, tell our listeners more about Asbury Research and where they can find you.
Sure. We have research services for both individuals and money managers. And the way to find us is go to asburyresearch.com. If you like our approach, feel free to go to the contact tab. Ask us for more information. We're actually running a 10% sale for individual investors only through the end of this month, through the end of March. And we'd be happy to send you information on that, along with some information about our models and about our approach to investing, so you can learn more about us.
All right. Well, listen, John, thanks as always for coming on the program, and hope to talk to you again in the future.
We've seen the decline of the Chinese labor force as when the latest census came out, of how the labor market has shrunk so much over the last decade. And that is going to be, as you correctly pointed out, the reality for China, as it is for many other developing countries. The real battleground for Chinese policymakers is, can they make their people, can they make their country a rich country, a high income country, before they become an old country, before the labor force, because if the labor force weakens before the economy graduates to a level where they are part of the of high end technology manufacturing, a consumption driven economy, people are spending money, that will be much better for China than getting stuck in this so-called middle-income trap and aging at the same time.
To listen to this full interview, in addition to gaining access to all of our premium content airing during the week, go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button.
Hi, I'm Jim Poplava. I started Financial Sense in 1985 to give clients a boutique, personal investment experience that's hard to get at a large company. For three decades, my company has been helping families build, manage, and protect their wealth through tailored financial planning and investment management. If you are looking to make financial sense of a complex world, give our office a call at 888-486-3939 to speak with one of our advisors today and let us help you plan your future. Well, on Tuesday, the Wall Street Journal reported that for the first time in 11 years, housing prices fell. Higher interest rates are obviously impacting the real estate market. So what do homeowners and investors do today? Let's find out. Joining us on the program is Sarah Lindsay. She's branch manager at Synergy One Lending. Sarah, what have you seen over the last year when we had these aggressive rate hikes? Basically, mortgage rates more than doubled. What impact are you seeing in the real estate market here locally in San Diego?
Hi, Jim. Yeah, great question. Everything slowed down. You know, when the cost of purchasing a home practically doubles, and over the last couple of years, anyone that did already own most likely took advantage of those low interest rates, it really caused a pause in real estate and lending. Two reasons for that. Obviously, interest rates doubling makes things more expensive. So people prices people out, makes it less affordable for them. And, you know, they really kind of question the high prices or the high appreciation gains that we've seen over the last couple of years, especially when it costs more than double to finance those purchases. And then on the refinance side, everyone has low rates. Why would you ever change that 2 to 3% interest rate for a higher interest rate? If people are trying to tap into their equity, what they're doing is they are opening home equity lines of credit or second liens for the amount of money that they need or they want to access for whatever reasons. Most of those are home repairs because people don't want to leave their home and purchase something at a higher rate when they maybe make where they live work with a few adjustments.
You know, if you take a look at the housing market for, let's say, first-time home buyers or those even trading up, they've been hit with a double whammy for, you know, from probably 2019 all the way through the pandemic. We saw real estate prices going up 15, 20% a year. And, you know, here in San Diego, you know, our definition of a millionaire is a homeowner. Then that's followed by a doubling of mortgage rates. So this has really been tough on first-time home buyers.
They are definitely the ones impacted the most. But there's still a lot of demand, which is interesting to me. You know, we have one of the largest cohorts, generational cohorts, coming into their peak home buying years. And they need a place to live. And their option of renting is also expensive and unavailable. We have an inventory problem nationwide, but especially in San Diego, where people just can't find a place to live to either buy and or rent. And although home prices are coming down because of the cost of that, you know, over the past couple of years, the gains that we've seen, yeah, we're going to give some of that back. And the most expensive or the places that have seen the biggest gains are going to give a little bit more. But with the amount of demand that we have for people just waiting for their opportunity and no inventory, we do expect home prices to continue to appreciate, although maybe staying level or at a much slower pace than what our historical norms are, because like you mentioned, 15 to 20% annual appreciation is unheard of. Historically, it's 3.5% for real estate. So, you know, we get closer to those numbers or a little bit below that, then we're actually in more of a normal real estate market.
So when you look at this, you know, I'm just thinking in terms of supply. So let's say,
you know, I started a family. I've got more children now. I want to trade up to a larger home. But during low interest rates, I locked in on a 3% mortgage. If I sell my house today, I walk away from a 3% mortgage, and I'm probably looking at a 6% mortgage or more on a new home.
Yeah, it's a situation that we call rate lock. People do not want to move when they have a home at a 3% interest rate into a 6, 7% interest rate. That's why more people are looking at tapping into the equity gains that they received over the last couple of years to make where they are work for the needs that they have now. Until rates come down, this is unfortunately the situation that we're going to see. That people aren't moving, doing their traditional moves, you know, every 7 to 10 years. So it's also impacting the inventory levels, as well as just the nation as a whole has been underbuilding for the past 14 years.
Now, we're doing this interview on a Tuesday, about a week ahead of Fed rate hikes. What are mortgage rates on, let's say, 30-year fixed rates today, with the possibility that the Fed, well, it's about 50-50, whether they raise interest rates a quarter of a point or pause?
Right now, interest rates on a 30-year fix really depend on the amount of money that you're financing, but they're going to range anywhere from the low 6% to high or to low 7% range. And actually, if the Fed hikes interest rates, it's actually helpful to mortgage rates. Inflation is the arch nemesis to the bond market, which is where mortgages come from, mortgage bonds, mortgage-backed securities. So as people flee to a more safer investment, it actually helps push interest rates down. So if we get a hold of inflation, as the Fed says that they're going to do, and that's, I know, a whole other topic of discussion, but eventually, you know, inflation will come down and that will actually benefit interest rates. And there's a whole issue there that I see coming up in the future with our low inventory, that when rates come down and those people that are stuck in those homes that might not currently suit their needs because they don't want to go from a 3% to a 7% interest rate, 5% might make more sense for them to make that move. So we'll get hopefully some more inventory. But at the same time, those people that are currently priced out at 7% interest rates, 5% will allow them to purchase something or get that back into that affordability range for them. So I'll have more buyers in the market. So with the low inventory levels that we have, I'm just nervous that we might get ourselves back into a predicament where we were the last couple of years with a lot of demand and maybe even some bidding wars.
You know, during the financial crisis in the 00 decade, people went into these crazy mortgages, 2 or 3 year rates. And then, of course, when rates went up, they got hammered. Given where we are now, moving from a low interest rate environment to the high interest rate environment, basically doubling in mortgage rates, are new home buyers getting a little bit more creative? In other words, going with a variable rate mortgage, maybe a 5 or 7 year lock, so they can protect themselves, but then have the opportunity to refinance if rates come down.
That is definitely an option, although it's not in all price points. And with how everything is kind of set up right now with an inverted yield curve that we're in, short-term ARMs aren't necessarily, or those shorter-term fixed rate loans aren't necessarily in all product points lower than 30-year fixed mortgages. So what I'm seeing more of right now is people doing longer-term interest rate mortgages. So like the longer-term fixed mortgages, because if you're going to get a 5-year, 7-year ARM that's close to the same as a 30-year fix, well, why not go to the security of a long-term fixed mortgage? But with the current market, and this is going to be dependent on where you are, homes are sitting a little bit longer. So buyers are now giving incentive, or sellers are now giving incentives to their buyers to purchase their properties. And that usually comes in price reductions that we've kind of already talked about, or credits towards closing costs. And buyers are using those credits towards either permanent buy down of their interest rate on their long-term loan or temporary buy downs, which are pretty, they're a little more risk with that product, but they're pretty creative in the fact that it buys an interest rate down more than a permanent buy down would on a long-term fixed loan. And it's temporary. So they'll have a couple of percentage points lower than what their actual rate is. And over the couple of years, that interest rate will gradually tick up to what their actual note rate was set when they got the loan. That gives them a little bit more savings. And those buyers are actually betting on a lower interest rate environment within the next couple of years to be able to refinance out of that loan into something that's lower than what their actual loan will turn into once it hits their permanent interest rate figure. So I'm seeing more of that on the creative side of buyers than I am on the shorter term loan products at the moment.
I've seen some ads where local builders here have been using some buy downs. So let's say you're buying a $1 million house. They may give some kind of incentive that buys down the mortgage and lowers the rate.
Yeah, it's very popular right now. You know, sellers don't want to reduce their purchase price. So I actually do a calculation to help people kind of figure out, you know, what is better, a reduction in price point, a permanent, using that money that the builder's willing to give you or the seller's willing to give you towards, you know, your purchase, towards a permanent interest rate buy down or attempt those temporary buy downs that I just kind of discussed. With mortgage interest rates, you can pay about a point to get a 0.5% reduction in rate. And so a point is, I'm sure people have heard of points. It's a percentage point of the loan amount, meaning if you're financing a $400,000 loan, 1 point is $4,000, 1 percentage point of that loan amount. So you have a buyer or a seller willing to contribute, let's say $10,000 towards your closing costs and you use that to buy your interest rate down. A permanent buy down would allow you to get that interest rate a little over 1% lower than what current market rate is. So that's a great option. That's for the lifetime of the loan. There's no changes. So if you're at a 6.5% interest rate, you'll be able to buy, the seller is willing to give you money to buy your interest rate down to 5.5% or a little bit more because it would be a $10,000 credit and 1 point would be $8,000. So 2 percentage points of their actual financed amount in the example that I gave.
You know, I was just saying, for an example, let's say I'm buying a $1 million house, which in San Diego is really nothing. So let's say I'm going to be putting enough money down, but I'm financing $1 million. So a 1 point buy down would be $10,000. And let's say the mortgage rate is 6%. So let's say I put 2 points down. Can I buy the mortgage rate down to 5%?
That is correct. On average, I mean, rates do fluctuate based on market conditions, but that's just kind of a good rule of thumb.
So you mentioned that homes are staying on the market much longer. So it's become a little bit more of a buyer's market in that way. But what about the inventory? If you don't have inventory, is that keeping housing prices tight?
100%. And I was just looking because I was updating a new newsletter that I have going out in San Diego County. Price points, so homes under $2 million or $2 million or less, we're still under a 2-month supply of inventory, which a normal market is about 5.5 months of supply.
Wow.
So we are still tremendously undersupplied and we have incredible demand. So brings me back to my point of, I'm afraid that when interest rates come down, that we're going to get ourselves into a little bit of a pickle that we might have seen in the last couple of years with the possibility of some bidding wars, assuming, you know, everything stays kind of kosher in the economic world. But that's really what I'm afraid of. And so I'm telling people right now, homes are sitting on the market a little bit longer because people are just scared. They're sitting on the sidelines. Things are more expensive. They might be slightly priced out. So they're waiting. And I'm telling buyers especially that you have an opportunity with homes sitting on the market a little bit longer to have some negotiating power with that seller, which we haven't seen in the last couple of years. But a normal market, a seller lists a property at a particular price point, you've been able to come in under that price point. So now we're seeing where buyers have a little bit more power to do that. Also, they can negotiate things like I mentioned, credits towards closing costs to buy their interest rate down to make it more affordable for them to be able to own that home. They have the ability to do that. When rates come down, which we are expecting, I can get into some details on why we think that's going to happen and kind of when that time frame is going to be. But that's just going to bring.
Please do.
Okay, that's just going to bring more buyers into the market. So I'm telling my buyers absolutely right now, keep your pulse on the market. If something that you see you like comes across your view, you have the power now to be able to negotiate and be able to get an incredible deal. I believe what I say. I just closed on a property at the beginning of March. I truly believe this. And we got an incredible deal with a reduction in price point and a significant credit towards closing costs to be able to buy our interest rate down and pay for our closing costs. Anyone listing their home right now is definitely motivated to sell. Sellers, on the other hand, I say, hey, if you could wait a little bit until rates come down a little bit more, then you're going to have a lot more buyers and you're going to have that control again of being in the hot seat or the driving the car, so to say, against all the buyers that are just want to purchase a home because they need somewhere to live.
Now, you mentioned that homes in the million-dollar range are holding up pretty well, given that the demand and lack of inventory. What about the mansions here? I'm thinking of some of the more affluent areas of San Diego, La Jolla, Rancho Santa Fe. What about those areas?
That's a good question. I'm going to actually look that up right now as we're talking, because San Diego Association of Realtors has a website, and you can look this information up. It's just in their fast stats that give you what's going on month over month in different price points. And so I mentioned 2 million and under being, well, really closer to 1 month inventory levels. The highest I see here is 1.2 months. Okay, so super low inventory. When you get into the $2 to $5 million range, we're seeing 2.5 months of inventory. And then when we get into the 5 million plus, we're seeing just a little over 6 months of inventory. So if you think about month supply, or in some states, they call it the absorption rate of homes, anything over 5.5 to 6 months is more of a stable, normal market where we don't really see prices increase or decrease. Anything under that, we see home price appreciation because there's more demand than there is supply. And then anything over, you know, that 6 month time period, we start to see home prices depreciate. And for San Diego County, as of San Diego Association of Realtors last numbers, which compares February's month supply of inventory, shows 5 million and above at that depreciation level. So we're at 6.4 months of inventory there. So there we're seeing home prices maybe start to lose some value.
Now, is this something that you're seeing across the country, not just San Diego? Because I know in San Diego, we have a shortage of homes. I want to get to that in a minute. But what about the rest of the country?
Across the country, we are looking at incredibly low inventory levels. Now, in these transitioning markets, it's really important to look locally to where it is that you want to purchase, to find out what your month supply or absorption rate is in the area so you can get a good indicator on if home values are going to continue to climb slowly or if they're going to start to depreciate. But nationwide, we've had inventory decrease year over year. It was about 9% nationally. So inventory levels year over year decreased 9% from this time last year.
Sarah, what's behind that? You would think, like, if I was a home builder and there was this kind of demand out there, I would want to build as many phases of my housing tract as I could. What's behind this shortage?
It's a really great question. And I think there's a lot of components to that. I think regulation on builders is definitely one of them. I mean, we're in California, so we can talk about regulations on builders for a while. But that and just the cost of, you know, they're dealing with housing supply shortages and the cost to build these homes. So it's really difficult for them to even build affordable homes for people to purchase. And they were scared from the 2008 financial crisis where they were actually overbuilding. So they're really taking a apprehensive approach and a more cautious approach to what they are building and when and why. And because of that, we have been 14 years below our 52-year average of single-family housing units completed for the nation. So we're looking at a very large nationwide inventory issue. And we're not talking about just homes to purchase. We're also looking at homes to rent as well. So it's a housing inventory issue. That's the biggest culprit, the biggest problem that we have going forward. It's not rates, it's inventory.
It was amazing. I have a client who has a house that they're building, and they've received all kinds of notices from the builders on delays because they couldn't get things like windows, appliances. So some of this supply chain that we saw come in from COVID is still out there. So their house, instead of being done in 12, 15 months, it's going to be over 2 years.
Yeah. Yes. Supply chain issues is definitely affecting home builders. So that is definitely part of the reason.
You know, one thing that they've done in San Diego, a couple months back, I went to a mortgage presentation where they were putting together a limited partnership and they were making loans to, let's say I have a house and I have a half acre. And the presentation I saw, the person that owned this house got permission, put two small rental units on his property, and the city got behind it. And as a result of it, the housing units were more affordable for people to rent. So a lot of these regulations typically are getting waived to some extent. Do you see that as more of the solution?
100%. There's been a big push to make housing a little bit more diversified to those that, you know, have always been kind of pushed out of the home buying realm. And so we see a lot of products coming out, which unfortunately just kind of makes me a little nervous. I've been doing this for almost 20 years, and I lived through the last, was working through the last crash, and seeing those mortgage products with, you know, low qualifying factors to be able to get financing. And some of these products that they're putting out to help things become a little bit more equal in the housing buying scenario markets is no income, no down payments, not taking into consideration credit scores, which really reminds me of some products that we had back in the day. What we need is not to create more demand, but to open building so we have more inventory for people to purchase and to maybe give some grants or monies towards those to build affordable housing or make it when you build a particular type of unit that you have to create, like you just mentioned, some affordable living options with each unit that you purchase. We need more inventory and we need more affordable inventory. So that's where I think our money should go.
Well, what we don't need, as you mentioned, is banks doing no ninja loans and no doc loans, the kind of crazy stuff that got us in trouble in the 00 decade, especially right now with the banking system losing a lot of money on their bond portfolios. You know, we all saw what happened to Silicon Valley Bank. So last thing we need is to banks to start taking high risk.
100% agree with you.
So, Sarah, in summary, what would you tell a home buyer? Let's just take two situations. First-time home buyer, millennial couple, starting a family. They want to get into a house. They're in an apartment. So there's scenario one. Scenario two, let's take another family that wants to trade up. They need a bigger house. Maybe the family has grown in size. They have more kids. They want to trade up. What would you tell those two? And in the second case, that couple has a 3% mortgage.
So good scenarios. My first time home buyers, I'm telling right now, is to get pre-qualified, find out what you can qualify for and the mortgage structure that best suits your needs. There's a lot of great programs available with down payment assistance, and those are going to be very local to where you are purchasing. They're usually city, county, or state run programs. So definitely look into those first time home buying programs to see. They have usually lower interest rates and give you money that sits as silent seconds on title to only be paid off once you actually sell the home, as long as you're purchasing it as your primary residence. If you don't qualify for those programs, that's fine. Let's see what you do qualify for and get your finger on the market. Keep looking. People are scared and it's keeping people out of the market. So you have more power right now to be able to negotiate something that's going to work for you. If you see a property that meets all of your needs, then you're going to when rates are down in the future and there's more competition. So don't be scared. Just get your information and keep looking and be able to negotiate something that will work for you.
What about the second couple?
The trade up, that's a really tough scenario mentally to get around, right? Because, you know, you are at a 3% interest rate. Why would you want to pay 6.5-7% on that mortgage? And I understand that. If a trade up is something that you're looking for, I would get in a position to access some of the equity that you have and see if in the future you can do that financing, maybe when rates are a little bit lower, without having to go contingent with the sale of your current property. There's definitely ways that you can structure accessing your equity to be able to purchase that next mortgage or using some of your assets temporarily. Because with lower interest rates in the future, and if that's what's holding people over back and interest rates start to come down, they're going to be in the market along with a lot of other buyers and a lot of demand. So you need to make sure that what you want to do in all scenarios are covered. And in those high demand scenarios, you have to be able to move quickly. And so get all your ducks in a row to be able to see, one, if you can move quickly, and if you can, what's the best way for you to do that and be prepared for it. But people are trying to make their homes currently, you know, doing some remodeling to them to make where they live work for them. And that might be a good option with just accessing equity to do the home equity lines of credit. But if you are looking to move up, lower rates are coming in the future. And I would also give them the same advice as I told my first-time homebuyers. Let's see what you can afford right now. Keep your pulse on the market and see what's coming around that you're interested in, because right now is the time for those deals. In the future, those are going to be harder, if not non-existent.
Well, as we sum up, who would have thought, given the doubling, more than doubling of mortgage rates, that the housing market could still be tight? Sarah, as we close, if our listeners would like to find out more about what you guys do at Synergy One, you do a lot of education, a lot of mortgage planning, which I like. How could they do so, please?
They can reach me. Easiest spot would be at my website, which is homeloangal.com.
All right. We've been speaking with Sarah Lindsay from Synergy One. Sarah, thanks so much for joining us on the program. Hope to talk to you again.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, Jim. I really appreciate it.
That concludes our weekend edition of the Financial Sense NewsHour. To speak with our financial planning and wealth management team, give us a call at 888-486-3939 or go to financialsense.com and click where it says Contact Us. If you aren't already a subscriber to our weekday podcast and would like to listen to more of our content, where we regularly interview book authors, industry experts, and strategists from around the globe, go to Financial Sense and hit the subscribe button. On behalf of Financial Sense NewsHour and the Financial Sense Wealth Management team, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
The Financial Sense NewsHour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the NewsHour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.